Hi, you're listening to your Route to Wellbeing podcast. This podcast shares strategies, insights, nuggets, and tools to inspire and support you as you step boldly towards creating the well-being that you desire and deserve. Each week, I share insights and inspiration from different people who have expertise across one or more of the 11 domains of well-being. Each one of the guests that I've chosen to talk to have found the clues through their lives and experiences, through their careers and their knowledge, that I want you to have access to. My big question is, how can we all pulse with energy and truly live while we're alive? I believe that these people that I'm talking to have some of the crucial answers. So relax, listen up, and thank you for tuning in. Please remember to leave us a review and also to share this podcast with anyone in your network who you think it may help.
Hi, I'm Sue Fullergood and I'm your host on your Route to Wellbeing podcast, and I'm so excited to be with you and to have as my guest this morning Angela Deitchman, who is a personal growth specialist and a leadership practitioner. She works a lot with the Enneagram and with deep meditation and with the very unusual but so crucial concept of joy. She's a coach. She runs transformative workshops and retreats. And she's really interested in how joy can be a navigation tool for balance and for increasing internal, especially, well-being. So, Ange and I have known each other for many, many, many years. We met on some transformation workshops decades ago, and we have worked together a couple of times on retreats and workshops, and I have the very deepest respect for Ange and her incredible work. So I am really, really excited to have her here with me today. It has literally taken us, I was just saying to her, about 11 months to get this date together. So this is a very big moment, and I can't wait to have this conversation.
Thank you.
Welcome, Ange, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. Very happy to eventually sit down and chat to our heart's content.
Exactly. So I'm going to ask you to just give us a little bit of some insight into your career path and your journey to where you are today. Can you just take the microphone and share with us?
Sure. I think, like most people, I have almost accidentally landed up where I am, or at least that's one way of looking at it. But underneath the various different choices that ranged from, I started off studying law, I did an undergraduate in law, and then fell in love with English literature so much during the course of that undergrad that much to everyone's horror, I stopped pursuing law as a professional path and went into literature and African literature particularly, and then actually worked in academics as an academic for the first bit of my working career, and then moved into an NPO that focused on providing education for underprivileged children, from that straight into Investec and the private sector consulting on Black economic empowerment. And where I am now is that I'm on my 20th year of running my own practice in supporting people and teaching predominantly around joy as a means to fulfillment and purpose. So that sounds like a really convoluted, strange path to have walked, but underneath all of those things was always the essence of me that from a young girl was completely aware of a connection to something deeper and bigger than the material world. So that has been an aspect of me forever. And I'm really grateful that I had all sorts of exposure in all sorts of worlds before settling into this career, which I don't want to do anything else ever for the rest of my life. So this is it. But I had a chance to experience the development world, the academic world, the private sector world. So I feel very lucky at the meandering.
Absolutely. A lot of insight, and that's how you best can meet people in the world where they are. And I'm sure that's stood you in amazing stead as you do the work that you do. So how come joy, Ange? Let's talk about how you came to the realization that joy is so crucial. And then we can talk a little bit about why the rest of the world doesn't see joy as being so crucial. Or maybe they just haven't thought about it. So share with us, because that's the insight I really want to share with the listeners.
It was just as surprising to me, Sue, to find my work focused on joy as it may be to anyone else, because I didn't start off with that as an intellectual idea or a strategic direction at all. It transpired organically that after about 5 or 6 years of working really deeply with people, both in the form of coaching, but also I do quite a lot of intuitive connecting with people. And I began to simply observe that the bottom line of everything that people were striving for was joy. And I tested it out for a while and began to develop a model that captured the different aspects of joy. And it has simply stood the test of time in terms of being in my view, the most valuable way we can navigate forward. People often arrive at personal growth work because there's something they want that they feel they're lacking. That could be success, or it could be a sense of purpose, or it could be a relationship. Or because there's something that is hurting, they're suffering in some way, there's trauma or a sabotaging pattern or something that is causing pain. So those are very valid entryways into a serious path of personal spiritual growth, but they're not actually the bottom line for any of us. And joy sits underneath all the other desires that we have. So it made sense to me to then work with what was at the core of all of our striving, which is not to discount any of those other wonderful things like health, success, relationships, prosperity. Those are wonderful in themselves, but they're not ever more important to us actually than joy. And that's how it evolved.
Wow. And why do you think the rest of the world, who haven't had your insight, seem to underprioritize joy? Perhaps don't even recognize that that is underpinning all their other deep desires and longings.
I think the reason for that is twofold, Sue. Firstly, that is the pervasive habit that we see around us in terms of what messaging we get all the time, in terms of what we should be desiring, what matters. And you've got a massive health industry that is telling you that looking a certain way and being young forever, that that's what matters the most, and you get tremendous amounts of external messaging from that. You've got other parts of the culture suggesting that security and lots of wealth stacked away is what it's all about. You've got a beauty industry telling you that looks and youthfulness are what it's all about. So if you are more plugged in to external messaging than internal messaging, then it's not surprising that you've bought into the assumption that that these external desirable paths are what you should navigate with. So that's the first reason. The second reason that it can take a while for us to recognize what we're really wanting is because it requires some measure of self-awareness and attention paid to who we really are. And again, that can take a while to become a dedicated path.
I think a lot of people say they want happiness and
Yes.
they name it as happiness, and possibly what they really mean is they want joy. Can you differentiate between the two?
Yes, in fact, it is really vital to differentiate between the two. I would say that happiness is what we feel when things go the way we want them to go. And that's great. Let that happen as often as it can. But when your partner behaves in the way that you would want them to, that makes you happy. And when your investments are increasing, that makes you happy. And when lots of clients are lining up at your door to buy your products and or use your services, that makes you happy. But joy is something that does not depend on life and circumstances doing exactly what you pre-think they should be doing in order for you to feel a certain way. And so the distinction is critical. It's a really great question that you asked. If we rely on our external lives to go exactly the way in our opinion they should, then we are very disempowered. In fact, that's a very precarious situation to be in, and it's not joy.
I was really aware of this yesterday. Just by the way, was my birthday, and I must have heard the word happy. Thank you. See, you even said it
Oh,
yourself. I must have heard the word happy a million times yesterday, not quite, but nearly. That's what everybody wishes you, is a happy day and a happy year. And I think so often we misled into believing that life should be happy all the time, implying it should be going our way.
yes.
And I think that's selling us a lemon because the road is long and the uphills will become downhills and everything will be transient. And I love what you say about trying to be more focused on joy, which enables you to withstand life going whichever way life goes. And
Exactly. One of the
gain
most
joy.
liberating things I think that I've learned across my career of such deep work is to recognize that the agenda of life is evolution, including our evolution. The agenda of life is not for things to be 100% pleasant, 100% easy, 100% comfortable. That can come along, and when it's there, that's beautiful. But for us to try to insist that our lives are for something other than expansion and growth is to go against the absolute deepest agenda of existence. So when we use joy as a navigation system, we learn that joy is what it feels like when we're growing. And sometimes that's also happy, but sometimes that's also hard, and it means facing something that actually we'd rather not, or pushing through something that we'd rather give up on, or changing a belief that may be very familiar but actually isn't providing us with joy. So when you work with joy, you're aligned with the agenda of existence. When you're trying to be happy all the time, in this definition of happy, where things are going your way only, you're against the very powerful impulse of life to keep on expanding and growing every form of itself, including you.
Yeah, that's so profound. And yeah, so maybe when someone has a birthday, we should wish them smooth evolution or massive evolution instead of a happy birthday. Yeah, that is so profound. So what do you think stands in the way of people having the dream life that they imagine for themselves or yearn for in their happiness-seeking mindsets?
Two things, and one is in fact what you've just named. If you are defining your dream life as being a path where there is only reward, no challenge, only satisfaction, no stretching, only ease, no risk. If that's your definition of a dream life, that's the first problem right there. Because again, you are attempting then to create a path that is not aligned with what the impulse of our evolutionary existence is and does. So one of the first things you can do is to redefine what dream life is. And that doesn't mean that we've got to then chase, challenge, or seek out pain, or avoid all forms of ease and comfort. That's going on the other side of the spectrum then again too. But what we can recognize is that what we all really want is to feel the greatest amount of well-being and joy inside us that we can imagine. And that we don't need to compromise on. But that feeling we're after comes from being in line with our own expansion, as opposed to being constantly comfortable, constantly pleased, constantly static. So that's the first thing that's in the way. The second thing that's in the way of a life of our dreams, I think, is our very understandable but common resistance to change. And in particular, I mean, what has got to change in ourselves for the next level of joyful living to become available? I think it's designed a little bit like this. I think the things we desire that we want that we don't yet have are a way, an instrument of the universe to invite us into a higher level of being, a higher level of awareness, of consciousness, of being true to our real nature. If we didn't desire anything, I don't think there'd be much incentive to expand, to change ourselves, to grow. But we want things that are at the next level of ourselves. We want to be able to create more prosperity. We want to have higher quality relationships. We want to be able to express ourselves, to be more creative, to have a child. The things that we struggle with at this level of consciousness are there for a reason, because they're the way that life calls us into a bigger version of ourselves. But that bigger version of ourselves is definitely going to require some internal change. Letting go of beliefs that you may have carried for a long time, letting go of thought patterns, of emotional habits. So our way of being has to evolve if we also want higher quality of living. And that can be hard, and we can resist it. I'm sure you found that in your work.
Unbelievably. And, I always think to myself, we go to gym in order to, push weights in order to grow our bodies or strengthen them or develop them in some form or another. So we want the challenge in the gym, but when we get it in our lives, then we find it so distressing. Why should it be like this?
It's such a good way to think about it, Sue.
So I think it is lovely to bring to front of mind that really important concept of this is the impulse for your greatest good for you to evolve, and that will require being uncomfortable. But I always
And for
think,
everyone's greatest good. That's the beauty of this. Well, certainly for me as an Enneagram 2, what pleases me so much is the idea that my growth is also what blesses everyone else around me. I find that very incentivizing.
As an Enneagram 2, you would.
Yes.
And as an Enneagram 7, I want it all. So it pleases me too to think that more is better. And growth is good. But I think that, it is helpful to understand the neuroscience of how the mind is wired as a prediction machine.
Yes.
Wired to constantly be able to predict what's required to keep us safe and alive in the world and to manage the body budget. And so, change is our brains and our minds are not wired for change. So we almost have to override this protective instinct within ourselves. I think it's helpful to really remind ourselves that it isn't going to be easy and there is going to be internal resistance and obstacles to jump over within our own mindsets. And that's okay,
Yes, especially if you have redefined what you're after. So if you're still after happiness, where everything is going the way you want it to go and nothing is hard or nothing challenges you, then a path of growth or even just any life is going to constantly disappoint you, or at least be disillusioning in some way. But if you've recognized that what produces real joy is the being in your expansive path, in getting more and more in touch with your true nature, then like you so beautifully say, you can even choose to go to the gym to work with the resistance, to recognize that there's this beautiful balance between stretch and rest, stretch and rest, stretch and rest. And I would say that, yes, one level of mind and one aspect of our neurology doesn't want things to change and has the job of keeping the status quo as fixed as possible and making sure that we are safe above all else. But in my work, particularly with my deep meditation work, it also has become so clear to me that we have another dimension of mind and another instrumentation, call it, in the brain that adores expansion, the unknown, uncertainty. We're also wired for mystery. I recognize that we're wired for stability and safety. But we also have the neurological and physiological instrumentation for connecting to mystery, to the unknown. And once we recognize that we can honor and utilize and balance both these parts of ourselves, the part that loves the known and the part that absolutely adores the unknown, then we're opening up to joy as a navigation system rather than just the security of everything going the way we predicted it should.
Beautifully put, Ange. Thank you for that. That really is, I love the way you said, balancing those two parts of our minds and the two parts of our neurology. So of course life would never leave us ill prepared for what we had to confront, ever, ever. And so of course we're equipped to manage it, but I think it's really is about being prepared for and willing to experience the discomfort and the stretch, the at times unpleasantness of the growth. And it might be painful and it might be sad or
Yes.
scary or whatever. And that's okay. It doesn't mean we should retreat from it and avoid it because it's those things.
Yes, exactly. To move yourself to a quality of life that is higher than the one you currently live requires, as we said earlier, the equivalent shift in your own consciousness. One of the things that I bump into again and again in my work, particularly from people who have, I think, misunderstood the law of attraction work and the positive thinking movement, is this idea that you can just manifest what you want by a few techniques and technologies. And in fact, the only route to producing a different level of living is to first produce a different level of self. And that's what we tend to resist. We don't really want to examine our beliefs and let go of what we always have clung on to. We get addicted even to emotional states like resentment and boredom. We almost look for reasons to keep feeling that way. And then we're trying to manifest our heart's desires, but we're not changing our consciousness, which is made up of what we believe, what we think, and what we feel. So there is a discomfort involved, but I would say that you can get to a place where you almost can begin to enjoy the stretch, the same as your gym analogy. If you're overdoing it or you're pushing yourself, then that's never going to be enjoyable or even give you the results you want. But it's possible to understand stretch as something that creates joy. And when you do, it'll still be uncomfortable as you take yourself to the next level, but your story about the discomfort can change and actually bring you quite a lot of enjoyment.
It is so very helpful to recognize that so much of it is in the story that you use to describe it.
Yes.
I just think back to my experience of my fall down the mountain,
Yes.
which led me to have many, many months of rehabilitation and pain and lots of struggle. And I mean, in real truth, I think the thing that set me up for success during that time, there was lots that didn't, but the thing that did set me up for success was I kept saying, this is an adventure. I've never been here before, and I'm experiencing things I've never experienced before, and this will grow me. So just really telling that story made it safe enough to engage with it and safe enough to open myself fully to it and not to resist in any way. So that was very helpful, I must say, which I think is what you're saying.
Yes, and it's one of the key techniques for being more committed to joy. I don't at all like the phrase find your joy, or seek your joy or follow your joy, because to me that suggests it's separate from you and it's waiting somewhere like a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow in your future. I think that that's a profoundly disempowering way to phrase it. So even though this is a whole lot less sexy, the way that I prefer to phrase it is to say you've got to commit to your joy. And that's not just about building in time for bubble baths and spa treatments. I mean, it can be that. But actually, it's far more about what you've just demonstrated, Sue, is we have choice over the story we tell about what is going on. And you can choose a story that causes you to feel fear or that life is unfair or that you've been a victim or that this is the worst thing that could have happened. You can absolutely choose to tell that story and it will produce a certain feeling in you. But the story that you began, and we can take some time to get here, of course, but the story that you began to tell is that in your very Enneagram 7 way, this is an adventure. I don't think I'd ever have thought that if it happened to me. But thinking that is a more joyful result for you than telling another story or staying in another mindset. So joy is actually happening at that level, at the awareness of what you are thinking. And the recognition that you have choice to change that, not because it's better or more perfect or more virtuous or more spiritual, I really couldn't care about that, but because it causes you to feel better. If what you are thinking about a situation doesn't make you feel good, that is the very first place you've got to shift if you're interested in joy. It's not simply about trying to find what set of external circumstances are going to most please you. And that sometimes can be the way that the law of attraction work is cast. It does so happen that the more joyful you become internally, the more that energy radiates from you, and it does make changes in the arena or the externality of your life, but only because it's coming through you, not because it's coming to you. And so taking care of what story you are telling, what belief you're choosing to hold on to, what emotions you are agreeing to keep feeling, that's the first location where we can commit to joy or well-being. I think you and I have the same definition, I suspect, around joy and well-being.
Oh, and I'd love to get your definition of that, but what I just find so empowering about what you're saying is that actually we have the efficacy, we have the agency to choose, and it's not that we are victims to our outside circumstances. Actually, we have everything we need every minute of every day to choose the story we're going to tell. And you really just put it, so beautifully. I said it in the way that pop culture says it and all the self-help books say it. But you described it in such a beautiful way that you commit to your joy, and commit to say telling a story that's going to enable you to feel the way you want to feel.
Yes.
And to recognize that you have the power to do that, I think is so empowering. And I just absolutely love that because I think empowerment and well-being are very, very closely linked.
Yes. And, it's useful also to just tell a very uncomfortable truth, which is that we really are not in control of what happens or doesn't happen in the circumstantial aspect, or the I call it the arena of our life. You have influence there, sure, but absolutely there is no human being, no matter how wealthy, how educated, how smart, how strategic, how beautiful, how young, how fit, that is able to control their circumstances. And to try to do that is a very exhausting, stressful pursuit because you are never going to get it right. Let's just know that right at this point. And also, if you are so busy using all your energy to try to force your life to go a certain way or avoid it going a certain way, then you don't have enough, I think, did you call it battery earlier or body? What did you call it? You called it body bandwidth.
Body balance.
Okay. You
Yeah,
don't
body
have
budget. I called it body budget. Sorry, I was
that
measuring
was
it,
it.
but that's it. Yeah, body
Yes.
budget.
That's a lovely phrase. You don't have enough budget left to pay attention to what you can control and be in charge of. If you are wasting your budget trying to force other people, trying to force the market, trying to force the politicians, trying to force your children, trying to force the weather to do a certain thing. We have a significant amount more agency over how we choose to tell the story of what's happening and thereafter how to respond than we do trying to create control externally. And if we recognize that difference, that is exactly the difference between the domain of happy versus the domain of joy.
That just gives me such a feel-good feeling inside of me, and a sense of well-being. Can you define well-being for us according to your way of looking at it?
Sure. And obviously this is a little bit of a verbal intellectual exercise, and that's valuable, you know, because that's always the first part of ourselves that we use to try to improve. So certainly we will do that. But I must also say that getting to know your own joy is actually not so much an intellectual practice as it is tuning in actually to your heart and your gut and your intuition. So it's useful to understand these things because that gives us some reassurance and some direction. But there's nothing that can replace teaching yourself how well-being and joy feel to you and learning that state, practicing that state, nourishing that state, and then keeping on learning how to choose in service of that state. But I have recognized that the feeling of joy or well-being typically has three dimensions: aliveness, ease, and love. Aliveness is associated with excitement, anticipation. It's got a lot of energy to it. It's that upper, you know, it's where energy is activated and the lights are on, and aliveness is one component of joy. But easefulness, which is more around feeling relief, tranquility, okayness, stillness, peace. That's not the same energy as aliveness at all, but equally important. That's the second one, is ease. And the third one is different again from both aliveness and ease, and it is the experience of giving and receiving love, which is then a connection to others. So affection, gratitude, intimacy, warmth, that falls into the bucket of love. And when you're having a pure moment of joy, you're really not thinking to yourself, is this aliveness? Is this ease? Is it love? It's organic, and it doesn't need to get broken down into its component parts. But where those parts do become useful, and where I apply this particular triangle a lot with my clients, is that I've realized that sometimes we get, depending on who we are, we get a little bit over invested in one or two of those aspects of joy and quite under focused on usually at least one. And that's what happens when we get imbalanced or when we're operating from trauma or when we are fixated on one of those three dimensions of joy. We can actually often cause ourselves quite problematic results. So if you're all about ease, and certainly I would say that's a very comfortable part of the triangle for me. Most Enneagram nines also very comfortable with ease. They understand intuitively that you can't be joyful if things are too hectic, too intense, too stressful. There's not enough rest, there's not enough comfort, there's not enough easygoingness. But you can be so fixated on ease that you compromise your own aliveness because you don't want to take risks. You don't want to do new things. You don't want to get uncomfortable. You don't want to get edgy in any way. And then there are other people that way over fixate on love as a positive feeling. And they will compromise their own ease, for example, because they just want to be good to people or they just want people to love them. So to hold it in balance and to understand how your wounding might have convinced you that one of those three matters more than the others, it's useful to have these component parts. And while we're developing in this technique, to pay attention to whether you are overinvesting in one or two of them, and to challenge yourself to value the one that you probably have undervalued till now.
I love your triangle analogy, and thinking about it as sort of an equilateral triangle is really
Exactly.
helpful. But it does take a lot of reflection, which I would postulate is vital to your joy. If you're not ever, as you said earlier, aware or actually having a look at yourself from the outside, then you really aren't going to be able to work out, what exactly is integral to your joy. So, yeah, you wouldn't know which of the triangle parts are underutilized. So,
Yes,
yeah.
I think that's a fair point, Sue, that there is a prerequisite to deeply value your internal reality, at least as much as you are investing attention in your external reality. If you are wanting to navigate with joy, not everybody needs to do that or feels aligned with that, of course. But yes, I suppose I take that as a given that paying attention to self is an absolutely non-negotiable requirement for a life of true joy, in my view.
And a life of well-being, I might add, because I just don't think if you're not doing any reflection, how on earth can you manifest well-being? So I just think they're inextricably linked to each other.
Yes.
So, there's so much struggle and strife and overwhelm, anything but the sort of ease side of the triangle you just described in the world at the moment. I don't know. I mean, that's just what I see in my work. Every corporate workshop I do is about how do we help people to manage their overwhelm and their fatigue and their, and sort of feeling that they can't cope. What have you got in your little toolkit or your rather over bursting toolkit that can help people from that perspective. Ange, can you share some tools and techniques with us?
Sure. I will first say, Sue, as challenging a response as this might be, it is important for us to recognize that a tremendous amount of what produces overwhelm, stress, and fatigue is the story we're telling about what is going on. And there's more choice there than we assume and that we take advantage of. There are, of course, some universally, unavoidably stressful experiences. But actually, if you're rigorously honest with yourself, things that are life-threateningly, universally stressful are probably only in a very small percentage of your reality right now, with the exception, obviously, of groups of people that at any stage in the world are involved in war or famine. There are exceptions to this, but for, I would say, the majority of people who listen to this conversation, as harsh as this sounds, I would hazard a guess that upwards of 90% of what is causing you stress is the approach you're taking to what is going on, and that what is going on in itself is probably not universally life-threateningly overwhelming. So that's where we start, is to value ease enough. You first have to decide that ease is valuable to you, and to value it enough that you can change the way you approach all that is going on in your life. So that's step one, is to recognize that much of what we experience as stress is our story about what's occurring and what's required of us and what matters. And you have some choice there, even if it's difficult choice. That's step one. But the second suggestion that I'd give, which certainly at this stage of my life, I don't think I will ever not have as a habit, is the habit of withdrawing from my life on a regular basis. And I mean that in two ways. I mean that I will withdraw for days or even a week at a time. For me, I go on retreats as a matter of course. I run them as well, and I find it critical that there are parts in your year where you are entirely absent from your job, your family, if possible, if you're in that stage, your identity, your everyday life. So that's the first form of withdrawal that I'm talking about. One of the most exceptional examples of this in the modern day world is the writer and philosopher Yuval Harari. Some of your listeners may know that he wrote Homo Sapiens, and he's one of the most prolific philosophers we have in terms of output and quality of output. And he takes 60 days a year out of his life and he does Vipassana meditation. 2 months out of 12, he retreats from his life, and that is not a person who is underperforming or underproducing in their life at all. So that's an example of how withdrawal from our circumstances can actually allow us to occupy them better. But I don't only mean leaving your life. I also withdraw on a daily basis, and completely set down everything that is going on in my arena. I use a particular form of guided meditation for that, but that is not any kind of requirement. What is a requirement, though, is to release, let's use that word, release your circumstances and rest in just the your own being. That is not going to in that's not going to be an abdication of responsibility. Your whole world is not going to fall down if you take 10 minutes to rest, and I don't mean sleep, I mean to be separate from your children, your job, your to-do list, your fears, your goals, your bank account, even your very personality. These things can be lovely, but they're heavy. So even when they are, I love what's in my life, but even so, I have to put it down. And I don't just mean going to sleep, that is critical as well, but actually being awake, but being free of all the elements that typically are grabbing at your attention. I feel like there's nothing better I've come across in my career than meditation for that. But there might be that I just haven't seen or that's still coming. So I'm not dogmatic about the technique you use, but I'm certainly dogmatic about what I call in my joy model rest, which is the experience of being separate from all that you carry.
I couldn't agree with you more. I wouldn't have said it in the way that you've said it, so eloquently and beautifully explained. To put down the load that you're carrying is just a magnificent metaphor, really, for rest. But I often say it in the, your nervous system is coiling in such a tight coil, and it needs time to downregulate and to come to a state of calmness, which it can't do in the presence of your life and all its stimulation and attention demand and rest is just so integral to joy and well-being and energy. Actually, without sufficient rest, you can never have energy. How to start, Ange? I mean, people who maybe just haven't made any space for rest in their lives. Have you got a little hack or tool that you could just offer somebody who's just going to go, oh, how do I start that? How do I just even take a step there?
I don't think it's any more complicated, which is the beauty of this, than simply leaving your life, I'll call it that. Leave your life for start with 5 minutes a day, and extend it again based on your own joy. I mean, I'm at the point where I'm meditating at least an hour a day, and not because that's virtuous, but because that is joyful for me, and it allows me much better participation when I am pot choosing to participate, but I regularly choose to not be participating. So leave your life, and that can be as simple as going into the bathrooms at work. No one will miss you for 5 minutes. Lock the door. Decide that that is a sanctuary for you for 5 minutes. Close your eyes, slow down your breathing. And a metaphor that works quite well, I think, is to envision yourself getting off the bus of your life. So imagine that your life is a big bus, and you're driving it, right? Or you're on board, and there's lots in there. There's lots of people, there's lots of goals, there's lots of things to do, lots of responsibilities, and it's lovely. We love that we have our life bus, but you can get off the bus and sit on the bench for a little while, And the bus is not going anywhere, really. It's not going to disappear and it's not going to collapse and it's not going to break down. If you just get off the bus, sit on the bench in the sun for a little while, you really do have to let go. So the moment you realize your mind is fixating again on something in your life, just remember, oh, that's in the bus and I'm actually having a rest. I'm sitting outside of the bus. So you just keep, if you're getting distracted, just keep realizing, oh, that shopping list belongs in the bus. So I'll get back to you. Right now, I'm just sitting on the bench in the sun. And do that for a couple of minutes. And then, you know what? You'll get right back on the bus of your life again, and it'll start going round again, and nothing will have been lost, but you will have rested your nervous system, recalibrated to put yourself at the center of your existence again. You can have a lot of effectiveness changing your breath while you do this. I'm sure you've worked with breath on your podcast before, Sue, but really that's one of the quickest ways we have access to change the pace at which we are thinking and operating. And while you're sitting on the bench and you're not on the bus, you want to be as deeply restful as possible. So work with your breath so that you can feel your own body slowing down and resting. That usually means longer exhales than inhales. Just while you're on the bench there, use your breath to slow you down. And if you do that once or twice a day, it will begin to change at the very most basic level your nervous system and the way and the pace at which it's operating. And then, if you want to, you can extend that practice to incorporating some meditation or some journaling or some carefully chosen music, if that works well for you, that allows you deeper states of restfulness. We're not sleeping here. That's another part of well-being that I know you've talked about a lot, Sue. This is a different thing. This is about stepping out of your life and coming back to yourself as the protagonist of your life. And it's as simple as that.
Yeah, I'm going to use this bus analogy. I'm busy moving house and business and practice, and this just taking some time out from the to-do list and the constant busyness in the head is so integral to being able to survive the whole thing. But it's really helpful to think about just putting the busy mind, the thoughts that will come onto the bench in the sun, back in the bus. That's great, because to acknowledge that they've come onto the bench is step number one, but to be able to send them back to the bus is really helpful. And
Especially if you do that with respect, Sue. I'm not at all fond of handling our minds or our egos with meanness. Like if you mean to yourself, like, what are you doing on the bench? You thought about what next time is packed, you belong in the bus. Like if you're getting mean with yourself and thinking that meanness is going to be your path to peace, that's a little bit crazy, right? You can't bash yourself into more well-being. So be super sweet to yourself. You will, and just say, oh, hey, you stay on the bus. I'm coming soon. Or, honor that part of you that wants to stay on top of things and wants to keep abreast of that to-do list or is worried about this. It's got a place. There's nothing wrong with any of these parts. But in that moment, you're taking charge. So you are empowering yourself to be the one in charge of all your various parts. And when some of the parts want to sit on the bench with you simply say, I'll be with you in a moment. So no meanness, no harshness, no forcing, so that we actually become the example of how we want to feel. We can't utilize a method that is different from the outcome we want. So if you're being insistent with yourself, then the outcome you're going to get is more insistence, even from your time on the bench?
Oh, and we're going to have to organize another one of these because I've just got another 150,000 questions waiting to put to you. But we've given everybody a chunk to work with, from my holding the space to download all this wonderful wisdom from you. So thank you, thank you, thank you. If people want to get hold of you, I know your business is called The Joy Studio, but can you give people an idea how they can get in touch with you so they can get more of this wisdom if they want to?
Sure. We're actually famously bad at being able to be found, but I do have a Joy Studio page on Facebook that a lot of people use, just called The Joy Studio on Facebook, and a direct email to angela@thejoystudio.co.za will also always do the trick.
Okay, brilliant. And you promise you'll, I know I'm going to start now for 11 months time, but you promise you'll come back again and give us
Thank
some
you.
More of your insights and your wisdom. Thank you. And I wish everybody so much access to that joy that resides within them. And I wish you more and more joy yourself, Ange, and more and more access to sharing your joy with the world.
Thank you, Sue. What a lovely platform you've created.
Oh, thank you. Take care and go well.
Thank you, Sue. Bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Your Route to Wellbeing. I hope that this episode has been really useful and helpful for you. Thank you to the team who brought it into being and to our special guests who so generously gave of their time and their insight. Please remember to share it with all in your network who you think it can help. Sharing help that really helps is what makes the world go round.